Welcome to this book launch of the new book, Privacy is Power by Carissa Vallese, who is an associate professor at the Institute for the Ethics of AI here at the University of Oxford, a fellow of Hertford College, and a fellow of the Oxford Martin Program on the Ethics of Web and Data Architecture. My name is Rasmus Nielsen. I'm professor of political communication at the university and director of the Reuters Institute for the Study of Journalism, where we explore the future of journalism worldwide and have done a little bit of work on some of the issues around privacy and data that Carissa will take us through today. My role here is to serve as the chair of the discussion today. So we all look forward to hearing Carissa talk about her important and interesting new book on privacy and how it connects with power, the power of states, the power of private companies, and potentially the power of us as citizens. I will ask a few follow-up questions after the presentation, and then we will have a Q&A opportunity for those of you who have joined the conversation today. If you could please use the Ask a Question function on the Crowdcast platform, then I will pick questions from there and give Carissa an opportunity to answer the questions and expand on her presentation. So with that, welcome to all of you who've joined us for this conversation. Carissa, I'm really looking forward to this. This is an important and timely and interesting book. It also coincides today with the judgment just passed by the European Court of Justice banning indiscriminate mass surveillance by governments unless for clearly defined purposes, periods of time, and with limited retention of data. So quite a timely, I think, reminder of just the big stakes that Carissa's new book is about. So Carissa, we look forward to hearing your talk first, and then we will take it from there.
Thank you so much, Rasmus. So I'll give just a little presentation about the books, just to give you an overview of what the book is about. I started getting interested in privacy about 6 or 7 years ago, and it started as a very personal concern. I went with my mom to the archives in Spain to dig out the history of my family, and we learned all sorts of things that my grandparents hadn't told us. And I started wondering whether we had a right to know those things, whether I had a right to maybe write about those things. And of course, being a philosopher, I turned to philosophy for some answers, and I wasn't very satisfied with the answers I got. And I thought, surely we have to work more on this topic. There isn't, or there wasn't a lot of work on privacy in philosophy at that time. And just around that time, Snowden revealed that the world was being subject to mass surveillance by intelligence agencies. And I thought that was amazing. That really impacted me in a very deep way. And that became a professional interest. I started researching it as a philosopher, and I ended up writing my dissertation in Oxford on the ethics and politics of privacy. And the more I read about privacy, the more alarmed I got about how dangerous it is to collect so much data, keep it indefinitely on the population. And it really seemed to me that the system of the data economy that we have built is absolutely insane. It's a ticking bomb. And I wrote this book in that kind of feeling of urgency and alarm that we're doing something that's not very wise, that has led to very deep trouble in the past, that something that has happened in the past is very likely to happen in the future again, and to try to change this. So the first part of the book is a bit of about how much data is being collected on you. Everybody knows that data is being collected on you, but that's very abstract, and data has a way of being sounding very abstract and sounding very innocuous. And I go through a whole day in somebody's life to just illustrate how much data tech giants and governments and other corporations are collecting on us. So some examples are data that's being shared about you includes your name, your age, where you live, where you work, who you sleep next to, whether you sleep well or not, what you eat, whether you smoke, how much you drink, how much you weigh, your credit history, your browsing history, your purchasing history. It's incredibly detailed, and many inferences can be made from that data, from your life expectancy to the kind of diseases that you might have in the future, to whether you're employable in a certain kind of job, whether you will pay back a loan. And all this data is being used to make decisions about our life that are impacting us in very deep ways. You might get rejected by for a job or a loan or an apartment. and you might not know what piece of data exactly was the culprit for that. And for all you know, that piece of data might be inaccurate, and we don't have access to that or any way to correct it or appeal many decisions that are made on us. Furthermore, another motivation for me to write this book is to refuse a very common myth and a very common conception of privacy as something that's just a personal preference or an individual preference. And the idea is that it's up to you how much data you want to share, and if you're okay with sharing data, then you have no reason not to. And what I argue is, no, actually, privacy is a political concern above all. And privacy is collective in a way that this myth that privacy is personal is really misguiding. So your data contains data about other people. If you share your genetic data, you share data about your kids, your parents, your siblings, and even very different kin that can be affected by that sharing of data. And sometimes in very profound ways. So they could be deported, they could be jailed, they could be denied certain kinds of insurance. And you have no control over how that data will be used, and you probably won't know what happens to it. The book then explains, how did we get here? It seems that, you know, if you were to explain this system to somebody from the 1950s, they would say, well, that's crazy. Like, why did you do that? And so it explains a bit how we came to this point in history, with the hope that understanding how it came about might help us in getting out of this situation. And the way it came about was, Google was a protagonist in this story, and although other companies had already realized that they could use personal data to target ads, and this became incredibly profitable, and it became refined to a very large degree, so that you could profile somebody for where they live, their gender, their political tendencies, their fears, their desires, their ailments, and so on. In 2001, the FTC, the Federal Trade Commission in the United States, had recommended to Congress that they regulate data because they saw that this could be something dangerous. And many of the advice given was along the lines of the GDPR that came afterwards in Europe. And just then, 9/11 happened, and that changed everything, because suddenly privacy regulation got shelved, security became the absolute priority in government's list of objectives, and intelligence agencies figured that they could actually make a copy of the data. They could make a copy of all the data that was being gathered and use it for intelligence purposes. Now, as I argue in the book and elsewhere in my work, it turns out that bulk data collection is not the kind of thing that is very useful to prevent terrorism, because terrorism is a very rare event, such that it seems that we made this incredible sacrifice of our privacy, and we're not really getting what we were promised to get in return. So the third chapter talks about how personal data is a kind of power. And one of the reasons why the big tech giants crept up on us was that we didn't recognize it as a kind of power, because it's new. So we're used to political power, we're used to economic power, we know how military power works. And one of the characteristics of power, and this is an insight from the philosopher Bertrand Russell, is that it can change from one kind into another, like energy. So if you have enough money, you can influence politics. If you have enough political power, you can influence and have a big military power, and so on. And good regulation is one that stops one kind of power from turning into another. So a well-functioning society is one in which, no matter how much money you have, you can't buy votes and you can't buy politicians. And there's this other kind of power that is related to personal data and privacy. And I argue that what's special about this power is that it creates the opportunity to influence behavior and predict behavior. And this is the reason why data is so coveted. It's not only that it can be sold. Technically, Google and Facebook don't really sell your data. They sell the power to influence you. They sell your attention and access to you. And this is why we didn't realize what was going on, because we didn't. The narrative that this was a deal, that you know, you got to give your personal data in return for all these wonderful services is a narrative that came way after the fact, when the deal had already been struck. Just go back and try to remember the first time you opened an email account. It probably never occurred to you that you were giving up your personal data. It wasn't transparent. We learned about this system when it was already entrenched. And it surprised us because we had this litmus test for whether something was a monopoly. And the litmus test is something is a monopoly or can be suspicious of being a monopoly if the company can make the prices go up and not lose any customers. But here you have companies that supposedly give free services, although they are placing extremely exploitative conditions and they don't lose customers. But the litmus test failed because there wasn't a price tag involved. And there wasn't a price tag because we are the product, we're not the customers. The customers are advertising companies and other companies that want access to that data. So we have to think more deeply about the relationship between personal data and power and realize that we are giving up too much power when we give up too much personal data. If we give up too much of our personal data to corporations, we shouldn't be surprised that the rule, that the wealthy rule and make the rules of our society. If we give too much of our personal data to governments, we shouldn't be surprised if we start sliding into authoritarian tendencies. And I argue that for democracy to be strong, the citizenry has to be in charge of data and in control of personal data in particular. I argue that we should think about personal data as a kind of toxic asset. And Bruce Schneider was the first person to argue for this. And I kind of expand on that. And I make an analogy to asbestos. Asbestos is a very useful material. It's very cheap to mine. And it's very valuable because it avoids buildings from catching fire, for instance. And so we used it in a lot of things like walls and buildings and plumbing. And then we realized it's incredibly toxic and there's no safe threshold. So hundreds of thousands of people die every year as a consequence of cancer caused by asbestos. And in the same way, personal data is very cheap to mine, it's easy to get, it's very valuable, it's very helpful, but it turns out it has these risks that we're not paying attention to, and that can really poison our societies. It can poison individuals by making us vulnerable to harms like discrimination, public humiliation, extortion, and so on. And it can poison societies by eroding democracy and eroding equality. We are not being treated as equals anymore. We are being treated on the basis of our data. And that means that some of us are treated better than others, depending on how much money we have, whether we're poor or rich, whether we're fat or slim, whether we're men or women. And that should worry us. So in the last two chapters of the book, I come up with some solutions. We need regulation. There's no way around it. But I argue that for regulation to happen, we need the public to be more aware of the situation and to demand that privacy be respected. There are other examples historically in which public pressure is really what has to build up before regulation happens and for regulation to happen. So I argue that we should end the data economy. This is crazy. Personal data shouldn't be the kind of thing that can be bought or sold. As long as personal data is profitable in that way, it will be misused. And it will be used against you, against us. So I argue that just as, you know, even in the most capitalist societies, we agree that there are certain things that should be off the market, like organs, like people, like votes, and like the results of sports matches. Personal data should be on that list. And if anybody wants to do something with personal data, of course, we should allow them to in many cases because it's valuable. So in order for you to get medical care, you have to give some personal data to your doctor. But those people who manage our data have to be tied to fiduciary duties. Fiduciary duties are duties that apply to professional relationships in which there is an asymmetry of power. So your doctor knows a lot more about medicine than you do. You're in a vulnerable position because you often feel ill when you go to the doctor. And fiduciary duties mean that the doctor has to put your interests first. And whenever there's a conflict of interest, your interests come first. So if the doctor would like to perform surgery on you because they would really like to practice their skills or have an extra data point, they can't do that. Only if it will benefit you first and foremost. in the same way your financial advisor has to advise you in a way that will protect your own interests, if they have interest because they want to buy a particular stock to try out how it goes, or because they have financial interest in that, that's not good enough. So in the same way, if a company wants to do something innovative with data, then by all means, let's allow it, but only if they can assure us that that data will be used in our interest and never against us. I have other regulatory proposals, like banning personalized content. It seems that the disadvantages are much, many more than the advantages. And it's a tool that is being used for political manipulation and the gerrymandering of democracy, and it's too dangerous. And apart from that, we should delete data. It's too dangerous to keep it data just stored there for as long as possible. So whenever we have used data, we should delete it periodically. We should have much better cybersecurity measures. Currently, the internet is incredibly insecure, and it is insecure in order to allow for the collection of personal data. And that puts us all at risk. Just to give an example, if hackers were to hack just 10% of electrical appliances in any country, and electrical appliances are increasingly connected to the internet and smart appliances, they could bring down the national grid. And that would be incredibly dangerous. Imagine being in a pandemic, being in lockdown, and having the national grid not work. That would be a catastrophe. So really, we have an interest as a society for democracy, but also just for security, to have much, much better privacy regulations. And finally, at the end of the book, I propose some ways in which individuals can protect their own privacy and the privacy of others around them. So, and it is a way to create public pressure. It not only will protect your privacy if you say, stop using Google search and start using DuckDuckGo, but it also sends out a statement. It says, I care about privacy. I'm not consenting to this data economy, despite what companies say. And it creates a data trail as well. So every time, for instance, you ask a company for your data, or you ask a company to delete your data, even if you don't get a satisfying response, it creates a data trail such that when that company has to face data regulators can have evidence that customers and users are actually not consenting to that kind of treatment, and that they should be treated, that those companies should be treated accordingly. So that's an overview of the book. I hope you read it. I hope you enjoy it. And if you do, please tell me what you think.
Thanks very much, Carissa. I mean, I'll wholly sort of second the suggestion that people buy the book and read the book. I think it's a really important topic and a very challenging book also, because I think as you just went through, Carissa, you sort of shine a light on some of the collective decisions that are made in societies and some of the for-profit decisions made by individual companies, but also at the possible acquiescence that each of us engage in individually. You know, I have what Aben Moklin from Columbia Law School called a machine that spies on me for a living in my pocket every day, and it is arguably busy spying on me right now, as I suspect many people, not all, on this call will have. Maybe a few questions to kick us off before we open up, and I'll remind people again to please use the ask a question function on the Crowdcast platform, and then I will pick questions from there to field to Carissa later on in the conversation. But maybe just a few things to get us started. I think your analogy of data to a toxic asset is one of the really arresting parts of the book, and really a powerful metaphor for where we might be. I wonder whether you can share with those who've joined the conversation today a bit more about how you think about where we are at this moment in time, about how much we know about the demonstrable harm of the kind of data collection that you're concerned about in the book by states and by for-profit private companies. Do you think that we are closer to sort of the say tobacco and cancer link? You know, I happen to sit right now in the 13 Norm Gardens building in Oxford, where Richard Doll did pioneering work in demonstrating that link. Do you think we're at the stage where there is a large volume of peer-reviewed scientific work that points in the same direction of identifying a demonstrable objective harm? Or do you think we're closer perhaps to the, say, the genetically modified food discussion, where I think it's fair to say that there the science is sort of less consensual, arguably, and there may even be some scientists who believe that the harm is actually not demonstrated, but where there might still be a case for a precautionary principle, because the possible harm might be very dramatic and well beyond the modest pragmatic gains that could be realized. So where do you feel we are with this sort of toxicity, if you will? Is this sort of demonstrated fact, or is it more about a precautionary principle at this stage?
That's an excellent question. I would argue it's a demonstrated fact, with the caveat that with political and economic issues, there's always more controversy as to causal relationships than with biological matters. But I think history teaches us that this has already happened. And if it has already happened, it will happen again. In the book, I tell the story about the Nazis. When the Nazis invaded a city, one of the first things they did was to go to the registry because they wanted to find the Jewish population. And that's where the data was as to where Jewish people lived. And when you compare the death rates of the Jewish population between the Netherlands and France, it's really striking. And the most important difference between the Netherlands and France was how much data they collected on the census. France had made a conscious decision for privacy reasons not to collect certain kinds of data related to religious affiliation, ancestry, and location of, say, your grandparents and so on. Whereas the Netherlands had collected incredible amounts of information because there was this one person called Lint, who was a fan of statistics, and he wanted to create a system, and this is a direct quote, that followed people from cradle to grave. In fact, he invented the ID cards. And this made a huge difference. In the Netherlands, the Nazis found 75% of the Jewish population and exterminated them. And whereas in France, they only found and killed 25% of the Jewish population. And that means hundreds of thousands of people. In particular, in France, there was this person called René Carmin, who was the general comptor of the army. And he told the Nazis that because the census didn't have this data, he would be in charge of creating a new census in which the data would be collected about Jewish ancestry. And he made this effort. What the Nazis didn't know was this was that René Carmi was one of the most important people in the French resistance, and he never intended to collect the data. So what he did was basically he hacked the Hollerith machines that were being used by IBM with punch cards, such that the question number 11, which was about Jewish ancestry, never got recorded. And by not collecting that data, he saved hundreds of thousands of lives. So we already know how data collection can be so dangerous and how it has led to genocide. And we can see in China, for instance, how surveillance is being used to control a population like the Uyghur, but also during the pandemic, there have been incredible intrusions into the privacy of people, such that we're already seeing much more rebelliousness from the Chinese population than in the past. And likewise, if you think about other kinds of authoritarian regimes, they tend to have a pretty strong surveillance police, just like the Stasi or the KGB in Russia.
I mean, I think your example is a powerful one, in particular the contemporary one of mainland China. I think is a striking and deeply worrying one, though I suppose your historical example, General Eisenhower might have said that the Allies went straight for the registries as well because they wanted to find the Nazis. And the data can be arguably, while clearly dangerous, as you powerfully illustrate, can sometimes be put to different uses. I want to pick up on your on these really powerful examples that you offer about, say, you know, the historical records of, say, the KGB and the Nazis, or today of mainland China's treatment of Uyghurs in particular. You use the term surveillance society throughout the book, which is, I think, a powerful description of where we are, both in terms of state surveillance and corporate surveillance today. And you argue that the data economy has to sort of be brought to an end, at least as we know it today, and replaced with something that puts the citizen as the center of this. I wonder whether you want to share with the listeners your thoughts on whether in the interim period before the data economy is perhaps abolished, you think there are sort of important distinctions to be made between different societies and different companies say, between mainland China versus the European Union versus the United States, or even between individual companies, between, say, Facebook or Google or Apple or other of the sort of tech giants that are central to the collection of data at scale, or whether you think that that is sort of enters into sort of a form of moral relativism that's a little bit like sort of arguing over drinks whether fascism or Nazism is worse, or, you know, Soviet totalitarianism or Nazism is worse. Is this for you something that is so clearly a violation of our fundamental rights and our autonomy as citizens, no matter how it's practiced, or do you want to draw out some differences you think that are meaningful between how different societies and different companies engage in surveillance?
Yeah, I think there's some meaningful differences. The most meaningful difference is asking, how does this company make their money? And whenever a company makes their money through data, that is the most concerning case by far, because they depend on that data and they'll do anything to protect it. So when one of those companies claims to care about your privacy, you should be very, very suspicious, because they are making their money through your personal data. So I do think that companies that use data, but not in a way that funds their services, are much less dangerous and also much more open to kind of changing in ways that might empower the citizenry and that might put the data in our control, rather than keeping the data because they don't have such so much a financial incentive. And in the same way, even though both citizens in China and citizens in the West are subjected to a huge amount of surveillance, there are still many very meaningful differences. And one of the meaningful differences is that if you, and I argue for this in the book, and that's one of the essences of liberalism, I think, if you commit a minor infraction in the West, say you have a party at your place and things get a little bit out of hand and music is really loud and your neighbors are pretty upset and they call the police, so the police comes to your place, they knock on the door and say, hey, please keep it down, and you lower the music, and that's it. And that's it for you. Those are the consequences. It's contained. And at most, you know, your neighbors are not going to like you very much, but you'll be okay. In China, when you do something like that, it counts against your credit, social credit number. So that could have effects on whether you get a job next month or whether you can travel as a VIP in certain kinds of trains or certain kinds of hotels. And that kind of system is much more totalitarian, because every little thing that you do counts towards how you're being treated in general. Now, I fear that we're sliding into that in the West. And when China gets criticized for this, many times what people say is, hey, that's an unfair criticism, because in the West, you're doing exactly the same. And it's even worse because you don't even tell people. You make people think that they're okay, that it's not happening. And there's certain truth to that. So in the West, there are systems, for instance, if you live in the United States and you buy something and you're not happy with the product and then you call customer service, the time that you spend waiting might depend on what kind of customer you are, on your personal data, whether you have a lot of money, whether you're somebody influential. And that's something that we don't get told about how we are being treated. So one of my fears is that we're sliding more and more into that direction of society. And I don't think we want that. I don't think that's a smart way to go. And we should try to start walking the other way.
Well, for those worried about what Henry Luce called the American century, perhaps wait passing judgment till you see what might come next, one could offer. Maybe just one last question for me before I start taking questions from the Ask a Question function. Again, please use the Ask a Question function, and I will pick questions from there for Carissa to respond to. You know, one theme you strike at throughout the book, and also have spoken very powerfully to just now in your presentation, is the idea of a choice. You write in the book that we've been asked to give up our personal data in the name of the public good. I wondered whether you want to expand a little bit on how sort of much you feel that this has really been a choice. And I suppose in particular, whether you have any reflections on the legitimacy of this choice, and in particular, whether it's possible that people may be what I think some commentators and certainly some industry spokespeople have called privacy pragmatists, that more or less knowingly decide to listen to your argumentation, say, well, we like convenient things as supported by data-driven ad economies, so thanks very much for the warning, but, you know, we like our search engines and our social media and our mobile phone, so we will just carry on with your warning in mind. How much of a choice do you really think this has been for us as individual citizens? Is this sort of something that's akin to climate change, where I think one can sort of reasonably argue that we have quite a lot of agency as individuals, and I can't, you know, I can't foist on the state and on big companies the responsibility I take on as a consumer when I decide to jet around the world and emit in tons of carbon into the air? That is my responsibility as a citizen, my choice, and I have to answer for that. Or do you think it's sort of closer to something that's structural, where it's not really meaningful to talk about a choice that I make as a consumer when I have something that spies on me in my pocket?
I think we didn't have a choice. I think we got duped into the system. And once it was there and once we learned of it, they told us, well, this was the deal. You knew about it. You know, you clicked the terms and conditions when everybody knows that nobody can possibly read so many terms and conditions. And we don't even understand them and they can change at any point. So I don't think we had a choice. But I think now we have a choice because now we know. Now we know what's going on. And we have a choice in the sense that we have agency in pushing the direction of our society one way or another. If you try your best to protect your privacy, I can tell you now you'll fail. But it doesn't matter. You don't have to be perfect. You don't have to achieve perfect privacy to make a big, big, big impact. So I think people would be amazed at how much companies and governments are worried about what they think. Their opinions are being monitored on social media all the time. And companies are very sensitive. If they start realizing that privacy can be a competitive advantage, things could change pretty quickly. So in a way, it's something like climate change because we have now the agency to push towards one way or another. So one of the aspects of your question, you asked, well, what if people just say, okay, you know, thank you for the warning, but I'd rather have like really convenient things. There are two answers to that. One is you don't have to give up convenience. So you can have Signal and have much more privacy than with other messenger apps. And it's the same thing. It's not going to make you lose anything. So this is another kind of myth that I think is completely wrong, that we have to choose between privacy and cutting edge tech. No, cutting edge tech can work perfectly fine protecting privacy. And the data economy is just a business model. We can fund these things in a different way. So you don't have to choose. So that's one answer. And the second answer is, one of the unfortunate characteristics of privacy is that often you don't realize how important it is until you lose it. And once you lose it, it's too late. You cannot recall it. So once you know your identity gets stolen and you have to go on trial to try to defend that it wasn't you who committed that crime, your privacy has already done, you know, been stolen and the damage has been done in a way. So, and because there is this collective aspect to privacy, and I argue that privacy is collective, it's not clear to me that we have the moral authority as individuals to say, you know, I choose to give up my privacy, because you are choosing to give up our security, and that matters as a society. So I think even if people were to say, well, you know, I'm not that worried, they're wrong, and we should take measures in, just like, you know, we should take measures in public health issues or in ecology, even if there are some people who think, well, I don't have any kids and I don't care about what happens to the world in 20 years time, I'll be dead, so I'll just like pollute as much as possible.
I mean, thanks for this, because I think in some ways this really puts it on the point for me, in a sense that you know, I, like you, was very struck by the Snowden revelations of mass government surveillance piggybacking off the infrastructures built by private for-profit companies in 2013, and all the revelations that have been enabled by his very brave act since, by The Guardian and The New York Times and others. And at the same time, I have to be honest and say, you know, I didn't change very much in my behavior. You know, I felt like I learned something, and I think there is an intrinsic value to knowing something about society being intelligible rather than opaque. But at the same time, I suppose that my sort of, in practice, my thinking as a citizen was that there are different incommensurate values here, and a traditional conception of privacy is one of them, but it may not be the only one, and that I might have felt as a citizen that my autonomy was in fact enhanced by the data economy that was so demonstrably problematic in many different ways that you outlined so powerfully in the book. And I really appreciate the book in part because it calls out people like me for being immoral, basically. And I think it really puts it a very sort of a clear point on why it's important to read your book and really think about the choices that we make individually, but perhaps more importantly, as societies. Now, as promised, now I'll open up and start looking at the questions. Just bear with me for a few seconds as I start picking a few questions here. Let's start with a question from Anna, who notes that you've been, you know, that you've written that 6 years ago when you started the work on this topic that few people were interested in discussing privacy. What are the sort of the changes you would most like to see in the 6 years after this book?
I would like to see much more regulatory changes. I would like to see like really important steps for banning the data economy. And I'm optimistic in the sense that the US is discussing different privacy bills, and I think it's a matter of time before they happen. I'm also would like to see much more effort from the part of companies to be serious about privacy and to offer privacy as a competitive advantage. And I think people will start choosing privacy more and more. In a recent survey I carried out with Sean Brook from Oxford, we found out that 92% of people have had some kind of bad experience with privacy. So I think privacy is something that we forgot because it was relatively successful until the digital age. And then, you know, these tech companies told us, hey, you don't need to worry about this. This is a thing of the past. And we sort of trusted them for a while. And now we're realizing, no, actually, this is harming us. And more people are having bad experiences. And either we are having bad experiences or we know somebody who had their credit card number stolen, who had a troll do something online to them, who had suffered doxing. There are many kinds of harms. And as that's happened, I think people will make more of an effort to choose privacy.
Thanks. I'm going to continue on with a question from Christina, who I think sort of presents a kinder version of the situation I described with myself. I am merely amoral. You know, I have sort of read about these things and sort of, I suppose, in practice, decided just to carry on. But Christina rightly draws our attention to the so-called privacy paradox, that there often is a discrepancy between people's sort of expressed privacy concerns in surveys and the like, and then their actual documented online behavior. So Christina asks, you know, how can we convince people that their privacy should not be traded for efficiency? How can we sort of sensitize people to a danger that is not immediately pressing?
I think there are many hypotheses for why the privacy paradox comes about. My own view is that it comes about because we feel we don't really have a choice. You think, okay, why am I going to protect my privacy if I know that I'm being surveilled anyway? If I'm trying, you know, why would I choose that to click no to cookies when I know like these other things that I'm not even being asked about are going on? And what I'm trying to argue in this book is that it matters. You shouldn't think like, oh, well, either I protect my privacy perfectly or nothing makes a difference. Every little time you say, I choose privacy, it gets recorded and it matters and it creates public pressure. So I want to offer people a view both of how much it matters to resist, how much they can resist, and what are the alternatives for them to resist. And I'm hoping that this might motivate us to be a bit more privacy conscious and a bit more coherent with our beliefs.
Because it's such a sort of direct continuation of this sort of area of inquiry, I'm going to pick one next that's from Anna, that she argues that surveillance capitalism, sort of a subset of the sort of surveillance society term, effectively outsourced the privacy management and guilt for this, you know, possible privacy mismanagement to us as individuals. And she is interested in your thoughts on what, if anything, we can do to sort of recollectivize this and make this as a society-level choice rather than something that each of us feel we have to navigate ourselves one cookie banner at a time.
There are a few possibilities. Some people discuss the possibility of data trusts. That could work. It would work something like a union. That might be a way to go. But I find it more practical just to think of regulation. Like we don't have to check, you know, whether what we buy on the supermarket is edible every single time. And how does that happen? Well, it happened through a process of regulation. So I think we're going through a process of like civilization that is similar to what we saw in the offline world that made the world more livable. Like, we don't have to check whether our airplane has gone through security checks. We can trust that our countries are run well enough that somebody is checking that. And in fact, we have many less accidents than we used to have. So I think it ends up having to be through regulation, but regulation will only happen when there's enough people asking for it. And I think there are a lot of politicians that want to protect their privacy, but they need to know that they have the citizenry backing them up in order to really be able to face these tech giants that put enormous pressure on them.
I mean, I wonder whether it's maybe worth pursuing this a little bit further, and just sort of to hear any sort of further thought you have on. In the book, you powerfully describe a sort of essentially a triangle with some element of a zero-sum game between, you know, is data a source of power for governments? Is data a source of power for private for-profit companies? Or is data a source of power for us as individuals, as members of the public, as citizens? I'm encouraged by your description of sort of the history of regulation in the 20th and 21st century. I mean, I suppose it might come across as sort of quite an optimistic take, if you will. I think it's true that there are areas in which we have made progress, and we arguably, you know, live in societies where, you know, we have, at least in privileged parts of the world, have to be less afraid that someone is going to poison us just to make a quick buck than many people had to be very, very afraid of early in the 20th century. And of course, many people have to be very afraid of across the world, including being poisoned by Western companies selling various things that are not actually fit for human consumption. But I think something that you made quite explicit at the beginning of your conversation too, and that is quite present in the book as well, is that while for-profit companies are often the sort of the interface, if you will, for this data collection for us, whether it's tech giants or ISPs or other you know, back-end consumer data insight companies like Axiom and others, are often sort of the interface that we encounter as citizens. It seems naive after the Snowden revelations to discount that the state is not a disinterested party, to put it mildly, and that it might in fact be quite convenient from the point of view of quite a lot of sort of executive arm functions, law enforcement, security, but also more benign ones, if you will, public health and others, to have, you know, mass surveillance available and to be able to either dip in it selectively or just, you know, get all of it through the back door, as we now know that some governments have done. And in that sense, I just wonder whether, is there a risk sometimes in these discussions that we get so focused on the very real problems that a number of for-profit private companies are central to, that we forget that the state is not a impartial and disinterested actor in this, but actually arguably quite central, and in some countries extremely central to this whole situation, and quite happy with it.
That's an excellent point. From the start, the surveillance society has been a covenant between private and public institutions, and it happens all the time. Data that you give to companies ends up in the government, and data that you give to government ends up with companies. But one reason for optimism is that I think the first reaction to 9/11 was very short-sighted. It was a panicked reaction. It was a reaction that was meant to show citizens that something was being done. In part because at the beginning, of course, it was secret. But I think more and more governments are realizing how dangerous it is for national security to have this insecure internet. And that is incredibly valuable to us as citizens and a very important realization. So you're seeing now, for instance, how the US doesn't want TikTok to function with China, and how more and more these kind of tech companies are having to put in security frameworks for national security purposes. Another example that I give in the book is with Grindr, and how, you know, dating apps are being checked out by intelligence agencies because it's so easy to get very sensitive information from people who work in the government, and then possibly to blackmail them. There are many security risks there. So I think that gives governments an incentive to make the internet much more secure, and we should use that to leverage our case. Another point is that governments are usually I mean, especially democratic governments are not like a whole institution that always thinks the same thing, and they're not an individual. There are many parts to government, and we have to make sure that, intelligence agencies are important and their voice should be heard. There are these other aspects to good democracy that may be just as important or more important, and that, you know, we should kind of have a view of what kind of society we want to live in, rather than make these very short-sighted decisions that might take us in a wrong turn.
Thank you. There is a question here from Martin Butler that I think is pertinent to this. I mean, Martin asks, given the business models the tech giants use, that depends on using our data, at least for some of them, as you've argued, this is absolutely essential. For others, it's sort of additive. Is it likely that we would ever be able to take back control of this data? And if I may sort of expand on Martin's important question, if we turn for a moment from whether we as citizens can influence governments, which you rightly argue are not sort of unitary actors with a single interest, to thinking about companies, I mean, one question is Martin's question, whether this is ever going to happen. I suppose a corollary question is, let's imagine you had half an hour with Mark Zuckerberg or Sundar Pichai. You know, is there a case that you could make to either of them about how it might be in the long-term interest of their company and their shareholder to clean up their act, or is your message to them, go to hell?
So yes, I think it can definitely happen. And again, if you look at history, there are things that have happened, good things, that we never thought it was remotely possible. A minor thing was just the GDPR. When I started working on privacy, people laughed at me, really, like, privacy is dead. What, I mean, you're just doing history. You're not doing politics or philosophy. And the GDPR seemed like something impossible. It's not perfect, but for all its faults, it's a real hiatus in history, and we have to acknowledge that. More importantly, things like democracy or votes for women or the internet or getting rid of slavery, these things were things that didn't seem possible at some point. And in particular with slavery, for instance, there was a very strong argument that it was just not economically feasible to get rid of slavery, and yet we did. And of course, you know, slavery was much worse than the data economy in many, many ways. I'm not trying to make an analogy. But the point is that we have done things in history that didn't seem possible. And again, with regulation regarding safety and food and so on, these things, if you were to tell like somebody who lived in the 1400s or 1500s how the world has developed, they would be very surprised that we have managed that degree of organization. And of course, there are many reasons for pessimism as well, but we should focus on the things that we've done. And what I would say to Facebook, I think I would say, look, you have a business model that's based in the past. If you want to survive, you have to reinvent yourself, just like oil companies will have to reinvent themselves, because there are certain kinds of models that are just not sustainable.
If I may make a personal observation, it's refreshing to meet someone who's an optimist in October 2020, and a real inspiration, and I applaud and admire your optimism. I suppose you're a person from the 1400s. If you told someone from ancient Rome how they lived in the 1400s, she would think that the world had gone to hell in a handbasket. I suppose I remain mixed on my belief in sort of the arc of history going in the right direction always. Nonetheless, let's turn to Jules' questions. There's been sort of a couple of questions from Jules that are along the same line, so I'll take the chair's privilege of consolidating them. But I mean, effectively, given that we have lived through a period of very sort of rampant data collection by private companies and by some governments, and arguably a lot of this data is stored, sometimes obtained using dubious methods, at best a gray zone, at worst things that are at the very least against terms of service and arguably often illegal. Do you think there is a world in which it becomes possible to essentially get this data deleted?
I think so, and I think it's necessary. And it's one of the things that we have to really change how we think about data. Data should never be held for as long as possible. That's just crazy. So we need to implement systems in which data gets routinely deleted for safety reasons. And it's not going to be easy, and we need better ways of auditing data. So one of the challenges we have is whether there can be a way to design data systems such that you can know exactly where your data is, that your data is tagged such that you could have an app or some kind of platform in which you could track it, and you would have control of deleting it, and you could check that it was deleted. At the same time, that might create a privacy risk, because of course tagging data means that it's being tagged to you. And somebody like Tim Berners-Lee, the creator of the World Wide Web, is working on such a system that's called Solid. And we'll see if it's possible. That would be an incredible achievement for privacy.
It's because it's so central to this question, I'm going to dive down the list a little bit and surface a question from our colleague, Peter Milliken. Because it is essentially isn't this question of data that's already been collected. And Peter asks, effectively, he asks whether our rights expire the moment we do. So, you know, do you think that people ought to be accorded a right to privacy after they are dead? And would you apply the same constraints as you would apply to the living, even after someone has been dead for, say, 100 years?
That's a question that has been in my mind since I started researching my family's history. And originally, I had thought that would be the main question in my dissertation. I never got to it. I still haven't got to it, I'm afraid to say. So I'm not sure. I don't think I would give it exactly the same value, but I think it has some value. So I think there are certain interests of the living that are more important than the interests of the dead. But I think there's something to be said for some kind of privacy rights after death. So say, you know, if there's going to be something that will totally ruin your reputation and that is not in the public interest and that is not relevant for the kind of contribution you have made to society, I think there is some kind of argument to limit what we can share. Say, for instance, on health data, if nobody's going to benefit that from, you know, in a medical way. And here we could look at the laws in Germany. Germany is one of the countries that recognizes right to privacy after death, but it's still something to work on for me in the future.
Thanks, Carissa. I'm going to turn to a question that Stephen Lawrence has raised in the Q&A, which is effectively is a sort of another dimension of the sort of reformist project that's been quite central to the discussion tonight, which is, what do you think about the standard of data privacy education in schools, and more broadly your thoughts on sort of education and awareness raising in this broader area? And Stephen remarks that, you know, in his experience, it's with in conversation with family and the like, it's quite hard to get people to care as they do not see the harm. Perhaps members of Stephen's family may be immoral people like myself, or if they're not, at least caught in the privacy paradox that was raised before.
I have a whole section in the book on children because I think it's so important. And I worry about us bringing up children in this surveillance society in which we teach them that essentially rights don't matter because, yeah, privacy is a right, but, you know, it doesn't really apply. And in which we don't let them mature, because I think there is a lot to be said for growing up without being watched all the time. That makes you into a functional adult. And then if you're watched all the time, there are things that you might not question, there are things that you might not do, and there are ways in which you might not develop. In schools, I think this is changing a lot. It's changing a lot also depending on the country. In the US, it's quite frightening the degree to which children are being surveilled. They're being surveilled for what they search on online, what messages they send, even between themselves. Their biometric details getting collected. And of course, with the pandemic, this has become a lot worse because there are a lot of children having to learn online and don't really have a choice but to engage with these platforms that are not very privacy friendly. I think the consequences of these are still to be felt, and that's one of the dangers, that once we really feel them, it'll be too late. But a few of the things that I worry about is not giving people a chance to really mature, not giving them the chance to explore topics that might be controversial because of the fear that they will be punished or somehow have bad consequences for them from their teachers, from society, from prospective employers, from universities when they apply to university, but also how they might be disadvantaged with respect to previous generations in that everything they do can have a consequence. Every game they play could be used to infer their IQ abilities and then make them unemployable. or any party they go to, they have to be aware of how everything that could be broadcasted, every picture that is taken on them. And I think this has the risk of creating people who are very tame, who have to comply with very strict rules in order to be a functional member of society.
Thank you. I'll ask just a final last question before we wrap this up, which is, I think, to sort of bring out some of the sort of truly political, really, in nature of a lot of the argument and also the position that you advocate yourself. I mean, I guess sort of simplifying and exaggerating, at least in Europe, I think you can say that the liberal tradition was always historically more afraid of the state and state abuse of power than anything else. And the socialist and sort of Christian Democrat tradition, in some extent, were actually more afraid of capitalism, really, than they were of the state. And social democrats were equally afraid of both of them. So where would you put yourself? Is it the state we have to worry the most about? Is it capitalism we have to worry the most about? Or is it both?
It's both. It's our data being treated in ways that can be against us and not for us. So I think really having fiduciary duties is one of the most important elements of what I propose.
Well, social democrats may not be able to win any elections in any actually existing European countries, but I'm sure they'll be reassured by the thought that they might still have a chance in Oxford seminars, at least. Something beats nothing, as I like to say. I think we should sort of probably wrap it up here, Carissa. Thank you so much for sharing your insights with us on this call today. Again, I warmly recommend buying Carissa's book, Privacy's Power, which I can't help but notice is entirely accidentally on display in the background of Carissa's living room, which is why I'm sure it's always standing like that. I warmly recommend it, and I genuinely meant what I said along the way, that I think this is such an important and interesting book, in part because it really challenges the sort of the acquiescence or pragmatic compliance, if you will, that people like myself, and I suspect at least some people who've joined the conversation today, have engaged in, and really challenges, I think, to think in much bigger terms about what the long-term societal and collective consequences are of individual discrete decisions that may seem quite innocent on their own, but that Carissa really, I think, challenges to think about in a very different light in a very powerful book that I hope all of you will buy and read. So thanks to all of you for joining us today. Thanks for all the questions, and apologies for not marching us through all of them. And thanks, of course, more than anything to you, Carissa, for this really interesting and important book and for your time this evening.
Thank you so much, Rasmus. This has been a lot of fun. And just to end, I would like to just invite people who think that it might be crazy to call for an end to the data economy, given how important it is, just to think about how crazy it is to have a business model that depends on the massive and systematic violation of everybody's rights.
What a powerful place to end. Thank you so much, Carissa. Thank you. Good evening, all.